Will Beijing bail out the rest of the world as it attempts to bail out its largest property developer? Are pension funds taking too much risk with your money? And what one Federal Reserve Board member actually thinks? All that and more on today's show. I'm your host, Steve Van Meter, and thanks for joining me today, because today we've got to continue on with the story in China because it has bigger implications on the world's economy. Now, there's something you need to understand, and that is how credit works. When governments or policymakers allow the expansion of credit in a debt-based economy, the economy naturally grows. And the looser those standards are, the easier it is to get credit, the faster an economy can grow. And it can even inflate at very high rates or even at hyperinflated rates. But we're not exactly seeing that in the CPI data, but what we're talking about is what's been going on with China. Because when you take any of these massive credit expansions and you slow them down, or even worse, contract them, it has major economic repercussions. You can significantly slow down economy, you can cause a recession, you can cause a depression, you can cause massive amounts of damage. And so as we look to what China's doing, the question is, are they going to have to bail out, which we're already seeing, the real estate market, which could have major impacts for the global economy? And I want to show you how that works and then answer the questions, does this even work? What's really going on? And again, as we continue the story, but let's start out with this slide here, which is the China credit impulse. Now, you may have seen this slide before in the past. We've talked about it on the show, but what is it? It is the monthly change of the flow in new credit as a share of gross domestic product in China. And what you can see here is there's a zero bar right here across the middle where a lot of the text is. And when it's allowed to slow down, so when China is either slowing its growth or worse, contracting its lending growth, what do we see? The world experienced a great financial crisis. The US stock market, nearly a double dip recession in 2010 through 11. How about in 2014, 2015? US stocks nearly crashed. They slowed down significantly and looked to roll over. What do we see again when China slowed their credit growth down? We saw stocks nearly crash. Now, what are we seeing now? Well, again, we're seeing it below the zero bar, which for US equities has been bad news historically. And so the question that many investors who follow China's credit impulse are doing are saying, hey, they're gonna be forced to bail everything out. And what does that mean? They're going to force the banks to lend. Now, unlike the United States, we can't do that. But back in Japan in the 80s, the central bank was able to force banks to lend, something called window dressing, which you can go check that out and look up how that works. Well, China, they can do the same thing. They can force the banks to lend. And so by doing so, that would expand the amount of credit and perhaps fix some of the problems we're seeing with Evergrande right now and perhaps some other companies that we don't even know may be struggling. And as we just saw in the China impulse chart, what did we see? It has effects on the global economy. It usually has a pretty good effect on the US stock market. But is China's credit impulse really all that it appears to be? Is the fact that we're seeing it head down mean it's about to bottom and that China is going to give in and expand credit and this is going to be great news for US stocks? Well, let's start with this piece by Gerwin Bell from the Financial Review, and he says, investors should be wary of China's credit impulse. This key economic indicator worked during the global financial crisis, but has not been a robust guide for investors ever since. And this is really interesting because he says, relying on this indicator or a lack of impulse control can lead to incorrect conclusions reflecting both misunderstood empirical regularities as well as the unique nature of the current market environment. And that's really interesting. So we see here that taking a step back on the heels of an unprecedented global slowdown, investors are grasping for any data, especially this, to help them figure out a path of the financial markets are going to head, because we have no direct comparison. So he says, when looking at employment data, inflation prints, GDP growth, corporate earnings, investors are on the edge of their seats for any new measure. And he said, what are they looking at? They're zeroing in on China's economic data or credit impulse, which, as I said earlier, is defined as the monthly change in the flow of new credit as a share of GDP. It's been a useful gauge of the state of China's macroeconomic policies, reflecting its post-Great Financial Crisis reliance on credit-driven growth. So this is interesting. And he shows this chart here, which I've got a bigger version of it for you to look at. And what we can see is this, it's effectively the same chart here, but now he's got this Global Manufacturing Purchasing Managers Index overlaid. And what he's saying is, look, China's credit slows down, and it doesn't necessarily mean that there's a boom in global manufacturing following an increase of it. In fact, he kind of says there's almost no real relationship there. So he says, by construction, the credit impulse is backward looking. The 24-month look back window is subject to base effects. We talk about this with the CPI all the time, a problematic feature in the current post-pandemic recovery, which has exhibited extreme data swings. And so, for example, he said, even if the most recent above nominal GDP rates of credit growth continue, the credit impulse, by virtue of these base effects, would continue to drop into early next year and only slowly recover afterwards. And that's exactly what this first chart suggests, is it's going to head lower into next year. So all that aside, he says, look, It is an impulse as a leading indicator is more asserted than empirically established. It were for a period after a global financial crisis when Chinese stimulus prevented an even deeper global recession. And he says it's not been a robust measure before, then, or after. But we still see signs of the U.S. stock market here. Now let's head over to see what Sonny Oh has to say. Is here's why the global reflation trade can survive China's credit slowdown. Because again, as you see this play into what's going on with Evergrande, you see how China is going to be forced to respond. The question is it going to bail out the global stock markets, or in the case of the U.S., send it even higher? So she says, could a tightening of China's lending spigots put an end to the global reflation trade in the global stock markets? Aha, this year as the world economy recovers from the coronavirus pandemic. And this is interesting because you're seeing a lot of interesting sound bites among policymakers in China, according to Marco Arno, associate portfolio manager at Brandywine Global. The continued discussions around property market leverage, ding, 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 Evergrande. These are all signs that this could be very coordinated, in my view. They're saying they may have to bail them out, is what he's suggesting here. And he also adds that credit impulses historically track prices for iron ore and copper, so we know those are slow, are headed lower. The engages of global manufacturing activity. Howard says recent supply shortages and electric car adoption have helped offset falling loan growth. So the key then is, where is this thing going? Is we see here's kind of the end result is, she noted, that direct payments to households and businesses by U.S. government are boosting savings in the private sector, making credit less needed. And that was from Tamara, a senior economist at Oxford Economics. So what you're seeing so far is one person say, look, this credit impulse thing, that doesn't really matter. It's old news. Another person saying, no, look, U.S. government stimulus has fixed all that. Except what happened to U.S. government stimulus effectively on Monday? It's gone. All we have left are the advance payments of the child tax credit. And unless something changes, those two are going back to revert to the old numbers. Let's continue on with the story because it still gets more interesting as we start to piece Evergrande in here. So now we're going to talk about the China's property crackdown goes overboard too. This from the Wall Street Journal, and the escalating pressure on tech draws attention, but the bigger risk is a new regulatory enthusiasm tips over a more familiar target. Now look at this chart. China's outstanding real estate development loans changed from year over year. Does this not look just like this chart over here? Let's bring it over so we can see. We have slowdown into 2008, 2011, 14 to 15, and 18 to 19. So let's see, slowdown to 2008, check. There we go, around 2011, check. 20 close, 20, followed into 2016, so 20, and then we have now. So really, maybe the credit impulse is actually has more now to do with China's property market. This piece by Jackie Wong of the Wall Street Journal. And let's see, she says, property is arguably the most crucial industry in China, including related businesses like construction, material, and housing appliances. And so this is key because despite Beijing's constant refrain that housing is for living in, not for speculation, which in China is the opposite, property prices, especially in the big cities, have continued to rise. And one reason is the housing market has long been an important lever, here we go, to boost the economy during downturns. And again, that's what you always have to look at. What are policymakers trying to do, leading to a seemingly endless cycle of tightening and easing, as we kind of have seen in that chart there. And the latest round tightening started last year with Beijing's new three red lines policy, capping property developers, hint, hint, Evergrande's leverage. Evaporating funding has crushed weaker players, most notably China Evergrande, there you go, the most indebted developer in the country. So this is interesting as we look at this, because the problem, as she says, of course, is a property is already so intertwined with China's economy that a sudden stop could be extraordinarily dangerous. And again, this is where we talk about that slowdown in credit growth in a debt-based economy, or worse, a contraction leads to big problems. So now, let's see what Evergrande said today. And so they came out and said they're denying rumors of a bankruptcy and reorganization after a weekend of protests at offices across China. And so the CEO wants the firm to repay all of its matured wealth management products as soon as possible. Of course he does. So here we go. Let's see what's going on. The company indeed encountered unprecedented difficulties, but we are assuming corporate responsibility and going all out to resume production and deliver buildings. Hey, when in doubt, get more buildings built. We're doing everything possible to resume normal operations and fully protect the legitimate rights and interests of customers, it said in a statement released on Monday. So let's continue on. The company announced new payment plans for its wealth management product investors on Monday, again, supported by Beijing, in charge of obviously letting them do a bailout in response to the rallies, according to people familiar with the matter. These products offered through its internet finance affiliate, Evergrande Wealth Management, are mostly owned by its employees. Even better, right? What are they going to do? The CEO says he doesn't mind being broke, but payments must be made. And here we go. Evergrande has offered three payment methods for investors, according to an internal memo on Monday. Investors can choose to receive repayments through cash, accepting 10% of their principal and interest of matured products now, the remainder 10% installments each quarter if they have it, or could accept payments through property assets. Here, you can have some property that might not be worth as much, or use the outstanding product value to offset the balance of any Evergrande residential unit bought. Hey, so if you actually own one of these things, perhaps you can get a reduction on your principal value. And how did the market respond? Well, here we go to Yahoo Finance. Via Bloomberg News, and the Evergrande crisis escalate as protests break out in China. Because what is the ultimate risk here is that investors can vote with their money. So that could lead, if investors, think about it, investors keep pulling their money out, then that puts pressure on Beijing to bail them out, puts pressure on Beijing to go to the banks and allow credit expansion. And that perhaps, my friends, could be bullish for the global stock market. And so the question is, will China bail out the rest of the world? We'll soon see. But pension companies, on the other hand, are busy taking on risk while we're seeing risk fall apart in China. And to this we go to the Wall Street Journal. Main Street pensions take on Wall Street gamble by investing borrowed money. Now, where does this problem stem from? In the pension industry, if you go back over the years, what you find is pensioners voted for higher and higher payouts, but did not want higher and higher funding requirements. And so the solution became is, well, we don't want to put more money in, but we want to get more money out. So why don't we just raise the target rate of return until we get the amount we need? And so it's put a huge strain on pension funds. And overall, they've been missing their targets. So let's take a look at what this article says here from Heather Gillers of the Wall Street Journal. And she says many U.S. towns and cities are years behind on their pension obligations. And this is even after some money was used to bail out and provide money to pensions during the pandemic. Now, some are effectively planning to borrow money, get this, and put it into stocks and other investments in a bid to catch up. And if you can imagine, the state and local governments have borrowed about $10 billion for pension funding this year. And you say, well, that doesn't sound like much. Through the end of August, more than any of the previous 15 calendar years. So they're borrowing more money now than ever, which is Incredible. And this is called pension obligation borrowing. And they're talking about Norwich in this article here. But let's go down and see what this thing does and how it can actually be a problem. With big pension payments looming in COVID-19 era federal stimulus pushing municipal borrowing costs to record lows, local officials are taking a gamble. That is, their retirement plans can earn more in investment income on bond money than they pay in interest. Hey, that sounds pretty good. Here's how a pension obligation bond works. A city or county issues a bond for all the portion of its missed pension payments and dumps that proceed into its pension coffers to be invested. So again, all you're seeing here is we're going to borrow money to invest it. Now you can think while we're going through this of all the ways this can go wrong, and probably will. If these returns on the pension investments are higher than the bond rate, so if they beat whatever they can earn on bonds, the additional investment income will translate into lower pension contributions for the city or county over time. Yay! The $10 billion in pension borrowing captured by the municipal market analytics analysis also included some money used directly for pension benefits. So, of course, they're borrowing money to pay the pensioners. Those of you who are younger think the Gen X and millennials, well, guess what we're going to be paying for someday? Rather than being invested, at least one borrow directed some bond proceeds to the uses. Now, pension obligation bonds can backfire if investments don't perform as expected. If we have, for any reason, the stock market go down and returns fall below the bond interest rate, the city can end up paying even more than if it hadn't borrowed, and they're already upside down on their payments. I mean, they don't have enough money to make their payments. So they don't have the money to make those obligations. And so how are they making it worse? They're borrowing money, betting on the market. And you could almost see in this, the future of when the next major market downturn happens, that's going to come in line with a pension crisis. You watch and see. All right, let's head over to see what recently one member, the head of the Philly Fed, had to say, and he thinks we should start tapering. Inflation may be long-lived. Right. Well, we're going to address that. We are going to address that because tomorrow, do you know what tomorrow is? It's CPI day. And we're going to have a preview. Next slide, we're looking at a preview. But I want you to see what he had to say because it's really interesting from the perspective of an insider. Now, the Fed doesn't meet until September 21st and the 22nd. Of course, everyone's worried if they're going to taper or not. So here we go. This from Nikkei Asia spoke with Patrick Harker, the president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia. Question one, August jobs were below market expectations by a mile and a significant slowdown from July. How do you think this will affect tapering discussion at the next meeting? And he says, there's no sense in my mind that there's a lack of demand. Now, keep in mind, hold on to this demand word for a moment. If you look at the latest jolts, remember we talked about how policymakers will fixate on what we know is likely bogus government data. We have a record number of job openings. And the problem is not a lack of demand, it's supply issues. The supply issues are due to a myriad of factors, but first and foremost is people. Whether they're worried about their children or elder care, they're fearful to go back into the workplace or to get on mass transit in major cities and go to the workplace. Monetary accommodation, here's the key, as delivered through large-scale asset purchases or QE, does it affect supply? No, he said it affects demand. So he's saying that QE does have a factor here and it's causing a demand issue. So he thinks by scaling back quantitative easing, that's going to ease demand. Perhaps he's not clear if he's referring to the low interest rates factor or if it's supporting government transfers. He doesn't say that, but he said it's a demand issue. I thought that was interesting. So he says during the onset of the pandemic, the Federal Reserve put in unprecedented support for the economy. One of the many things we did was restart our QE purchases in order to do two things. One is to provide monetary accommodation. The other was to get treasury and mortgage-backed markets functioning again. Well, they're doing okay today. He says the markets are functioning, and he's saying, I want to move into a taper process and let it run somewhere between 8 to 12 months. So he wants to unwind this thing fast, really fast. And the next question, do you think it's appropriate to announce plans to start tapering at the next meeting? Here's the key, it has not been decided. And I'd rather not comment because he's not in charge of making the decision. comes to Powell and his vice chair. When is your forecast for when interest rates will go up? He's saying in late 22 or 23. If you start this tapering process, let that sink to the economy and we'll see how the market reacts. Well, we know how the market reacts. It doesn't like it. And they're asking now, has there been any change in his forecast? No. And he says, are there any elevated risks of inflation? And he says he thinks inflation is going to get up to around 4% this year and then fall back to 2% over 2022 and 2023. And he says, this is a great question. Some say rising inflation will help achieve maximum employment. How do you see it? And he says, I am fully supportive of our monetary policy framework where the inflation target is 2% and we average that. We're going to run over 2%, and that's a good thing, given our new framework. So we just have to minimize the risk and hope it doesn't run significantly beyond that. So I find that interesting that he said we had a tight labor market before with a 2% target before, so we're all good. So the question is, are they going to get what they want? Here's your CPI preview. We have CPI in blue year over year and West Texas Intermediate crude in red year over year. And while you see they're not perfectly aligned, you can starting kind of after 2002, they became much more in sync. They were fairly decent here, but look how much more in sync they were. So as the year over year rate change in crude oil goes down and it's expected to continue to fall, where do you think that if the CPI is eventually going to head? Sharply lower, just like we saw during the great financial crisis. All right, let's hit into some economic data real quick. We've got producer prices coming out of Japan at a big goose egg, down from 1.1 to zero. So there is a massive disinflationary move in producer prices. Remember, we said this was going to happen at some point. How about we look over into Germany? Wholesale prices month over month went from 1.1 to 0.5. So what do you, that's disinflationary. And what happens is producer prices, now I know that was Japan, this is Germany, but just think as producer prices flatten out, wholesale prices will flatten out, consumer prices will too flatten out. Let's take a look at the data from the lending growth. Bank credit up $49 billion, so still banks expanding, but securities and bank credit up $29. You want to talk about taper, how about mortgage-backed securities up $13 billion? If the Fed's going to unwind these things, why would the banks still be buying them? U.S. Treasuries up $12 billion, even though nobody wants to buy them. Loans and leases up $20 billion. Commercial industrial up $3 billion. Real estate up $5 billion. Consumer loans are up $3 billion. What's driving all this? Other loans at $8 billion, but cash continuing to pile up in banks at $41 billion. There's your downward pressure on the front end of the curve. And let's wrap up with just a quick look at the credit conditions, and then probably on Wednesday we'll look at the speculative positions from the hedge funds. Real estate loan growth coming up to 0.61, so that drop in interest rates has helped spur some lending growth, but the three-month rate change is getting flattening out at 1.34. Should push the year-over-year up into the 3 to 4% range. How about commercial industrial loans? This is flatlining. The three-month rate change is stagnating around minus 4%, so don't look for anything other than base effects to push these numbers up unless we see some increase in commercial and industrial lending. And how about total loans and leases to all bank credit? Well, for all the low interest rates we've gotten, is the growth rate is up to, total growth rate year over year is up to -0.5%. The three-month rate change is at 0.35, and the six-month is at 0.35, three-month is at 0.88. Both those are rising, and it's only mainly due to real estate and the other loan growth, which is margin debt. How about consumer loans that are still driving the bus? Year-over-year rate change in credit card lending up 2.94% from a year ago. And with that, anyways, appreciate you being fans. Appreciate you supporting the show. And of course, we'll be back on Wednesday for the show and an update with the CPI numbers. I'm going to guess that we're going to start to see a slowdown, which the market is not expecting. But the bond market, as you know, that's why we're sitting out at the racetrack. It's getting ready for a big move higher. I'll see you on Wednesday. Bye now. The content of this video is provided as educational information only. It's not intended to provide investor or other advice. Materials not to be construed as recognition or solicitation by or selling a security, financial instrument, or participating in a particular trading strategy. This video was prepared by Steve Van Meter. In personal capacity, opinions expressed in this video or that of my own do not affect the view of Alice Financial Advisors, Inc. or Steve Van Meter Financial.